Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. You know, when you think about genetics, it is so tempting to just imagine this perfectly organized control panel.
Right. Oh, yeah, totally. Like a clean, logical machine.
Right, exactly. You flip a specific switch, and a specific light turns on. But we're facing this massive mystery in modern genetics right now. Over the past couple of decades, we have found thousands of genetic variants that are linked to human diseases.
Right.
But the vast majority of them, they sit in the non-coding regions of our DNA. So they don't actually build the proteins that make up our bodies.
No, they don't. They instead affect gene expression, meaning they control how other genes are turned on or off.
Right, they're like the regulatory wiring.
Yeah.
But here is the really bizarre part. If you look at the local genetic variants sitting right next to a specific gene, what geneticists call the cis region, those local variants only explain a tiny fraction of that gene's behavior.
Yeah, it's a surprisingly small amount.
It is. The vast majority of the control actually comes from the trans region. Yeah. And these are genetic variants sprawling across the entire genome, you know, sometimes sitting on completely different chromosomes.
It really is wild. It's the biological equivalent of, say, finding a light switch in a building in New York and then realizing it controls a bulb in Tokyo.
Yes.
And you have absolutely no idea how the wire connects them because it's completely hidden in the walls.
Exactly. So the core dilemma for us in this deep dive is, well, how do we map out a genetic wiring system that we can't physically see?
Right.
What really happens when a single genetic mutation sends a ripple effect across an entire network of genes? Today, we celebrate the work of researchers from Stanford University, UCSF, Columbia University, and Genentech, who have advanced our understanding of the genetic architecture of gene expression.
And I have to say, it is just a phenomenal piece of computational biology.
It really is.
But to fully grasp what they've accomplished, I think we need to first untangle the statistical paradox of those cis versus trans genetic effects you just mentioned.
Yeah, let's get into that.
So in modern genomics, researchers look for EQTLs. That's expression quantitative trait loci.
Which is quite the mouthful.
It really is. But it basically just means a genetic variant that changes how much of a target gene is expressed.
Okay, so let's break that down for the listener. An EQTL is essentially just a volume knob for a gene, right?
Exactly.
It dictates whether a gene is shouting its instructions or just whispering them.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. Now, those local volume knobs, the cis EQTLs, they sit right next door to their target gene. And when we look at bulk tissue studies, these local cis effects, they explain a median of only about 20% of the genetic variance in a gene's expression.
Wow, 20%, which means a massive 80% of the genetic influence is coming from somewhere else entirely.
Right, from the trans EQTLs.
Yeah.
The distant regulators are absolutely doing the heavy lifting in shaping our biology. But this introduces this massive paradox for researchers, because even though trans EQTLs dominate the overall variance of gene expression, their individual effect sizes are tiny.
Wait, how tiny are we talking?
Well, to put specific numbers to it, the typical local cis EQTL has an effect size of 0.14. That's measured in standard deviations of expression.
Standard deviations of expression, meaning like how wildly the gene's volume knob can be turned up or down by that single variant.
Correct. Meanwhile, the typical distant trans EQTL has an effect size of just 0.07.
Oh, wow. So it's exactly half as strong as the local variant.
Right. It's incredibly faint.
Okay, let me push back on this for a second, because I want to make sure we aren't just, you know, chasing ghosts in the data here. If these distant trans EQTLs are individually so weak, how can we be sure they collectively dominate the genetic variants?
That's a great question.
I mean, is it possible the genome is just filled with random, unstructured noise that we are misinterpreting as a hidden system?
It's a crucial thing to ask. But the reason we know it isn't just random noise comes from twin studies.
Okay, twin studies.
Yeah. By comparing the gene expression of identical twins who share 100% of their DNA with fraternal twins who share about 50%, we can mathematically isolate exactly how much of a gene's expression is driven by pure genetics.
Right, as opposed to environmental factors or diet or whatever.
Exactly. And those studies consistently prove that the distant transgenetic effects are very real and they are massive in aggregate. So the problem isn't that they're noise. The problem is just discovering them.
Because they're so weak individually.
Because they're weak, and because they could be located anywhere in the 3 billion base pairs of the human genome.
Right.
To find them, you have to test millions of genetic variants against thousands of genes. And in statistics, this creates a punishing multiple testing burden.
Meaning, if you run a million random tests, statistical chance just guarantees you'll find thousands of false positives, right?
Precisely. So to adjust for that, researchers have to set their threshold for proof so high that the real but individually weak trans signals just get completely filtered out alongside the noise.
You're practically invisible.
Totally invisible to standard observational methods.
So to find this hidden wiring system, the researchers, they couldn't just sequence more genomes or look at more raw data.
No, the signals are just too faint to survive that statistical penalty. They realized they needed a completely different approach.
Sure.
Instead of trying to observe the impossible, they decided to mathematically simulate the wiring of the genome.
So they built a virtual simulation of human biology.
Exactly. They built a highly sophisticated two-part computational model to simulate gene regulatory networks, or GRNs.
Okay, walk me through how you even build something like that.
Well, part one was entirely focused on the structural map, the architecture itself. They utilized a class of graph-generating algorithms. First, they used a planted partition model, or PPM.
Okay, planted partition model. Let's unpack the mechanism there for a second. How does that actually build a biological network?
So a planted partition model mathematically simulates modularity. It doesn't just connect genes randomly. It forces them to group into interacting modules.
Kind of like sorting employees into specific departments in a corporation where they mostly just talk to each other.
Exactly like that. And then, layered on top of that, they used a directed scale-free algorithm which simulates regulatory hubs.
Meaning they programmed in master regulator genes, like the executives of those departments who can issue orders to many different downstream genes at once.
You got it. So that is the structural foundation. But, you know, a map doesn't tell you how fast the cars are driving.
Right, you need to see the actual traffic.
Which brings us to part two. Measuring the traffic on that network. To do this, they applied a linear structural equation model, an S, to calculate the flow of genetic effects through these virtual networks.
Wait, a linear structural equation model? Does that mean they are just calculating straight line math, or are they actually simulating the biological time delays and feedback loops of these genetic signals in real time?
In this specific study, they just used straight line math to simulate a steady state.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it doesn't factor in dynamic time delays. It essentially says, you know, if the expression of gene A goes up by one unit, the expression of gene B changes by a fixed linear fraction.
Makes sense to keep it computable, I guess.
Right. So they mathematically injected virtual genetic mutations into the simulation and then measured how those ripples of variance flowed linearly from one gene to the next. And using this two-part system, they generated 10,000 completely different synthetic networks.
Wow. Simulating 10,000 distinct biological networks just sounds computationally massive. How do they even determine the parameters for all those variations? I mean, they couldn't have just guessed what an executive gene looks like.
No, they didn't guess at all. They systematically varied the architecture across multiple scales to cover pretty much all biological possibilities.
Okay.
They changed the local structures, testing tiny regulatory motifs like triangles, where gene A regulates gene B and C, but B also regulates C.
Creating a sort of feed-forward loop?
Exactly. Then they change the group structures, dialing the modularity up and down to see what happens when those departments are isolated versus highly integrated.
Okay.
And finally, they change the global structure, adding or removing those massive hub regulators.
So if I'm getting this right, instead of just watching cars drive around blindly and trying to guess the shape of the roads, they built 10,000 different virtual city roadmaps.
Yes.
Some with neat localized grids, some with massive sprawling highways, some with tangled roundabouts. And they wanted to see which exact map perfectly reproduces the real-world traffic data we observe in human biology.
That captures the methodology beautifully, yeah. And the real-world traffic data they used for the ultimate comparison was an incredibly robust twin study of whole blood expression. Okay.
It involved 5,902 genes. And in that specific twin study, the median cis heritability fraction was 0.28.
So in simple terms, if we look at actual human blood, only 28% of the genetic behavior is controlled by the genes living next door.
Right.
That gives the researchers a very hard, mathematically precise target to hit with their simulations then.
Exactly. Out of those 10,000 virtual roadmaps, they had to find the ones that naturally produced that exact 28% local versus 72% distant split.
And how many actually hit the target?
Out of the 10,000 networks they simulated, only 250 closely matched the real twin study data.
Oh, wow. So it's a really narrow window of what biologically works.
Extremely narrow. And when you isolate those 250 winning networks and study their topology, you find that they share four very specific, highly striking properties that tell us how our biology is actually wired.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first property is sparsity. The real genetic network is remarkably sparse. Sparse. Meaning genes aren't just constantly talking to every other gene in the cell.
Right. In the networks that actually mirror human biology, the typical gene only has about 8 direct regulators.
Just 8.
Just 8. It is not a massive, tangled hairball where everything regulates everything. The connections are highly deliberate and very limited.
I have to ask why, though.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't having more regulators give a cell better, more nuanced control over its biology? Why cap it at around 8?
It really comes down to the biological cost of noise.
Oh.
Every new regulator you add to a network introduces another potential point of failure and another source of random statistical noise. If a gene had hundreds of direct regulators, the actual biological signal would just be drowned out by the sheer volume of conflicting instructions.
So sparsity keeps the signal clear and energetically efficient.
Exactly.
But that structural efficiency naturally leads to a secondary problem, though, doesn't it?
Right.
The network is incredibly sparse. That implies weak, distant signals could easily just fizzle out before they ever reach their target bulb. How do these faint trans signals actually survive the journey across the genome?
And that brings us to the second property, positivity. The winning networks possess significantly more activators than repressors.
Positivity, okay.
When you look at those local motifs we discussed, the triangular feed-forward loops, they tend to be highly coherent.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning, if a master regulator turns on a middleman gene, and they both send signals to turn on a final target gene, those signals add together, they compound.
Ah, I see. So distant signals literally require a chain of biological cheerleaders, activators, to amplify them.
Yes, otherwise they would just dampen down into nothing before reaching the end of the line. The biology actively favors amplification over repression in these distant regulatory paths.
So if the genome relied heavily on repressors, the trans effects would basically cancel each other out in the mathematical wash.
Exactly. Positivity acts as a necessary amplifier.
Okay, so we have a sparse network,
okay,
and it is largely positive. What does the architecture look like when we zoom out to the macro level?
Well, the third property is that the winning architectures rely heavily on modularity and hubs.
Right, the departments and the executives.
Exactly. Genes cluster together in highly cohesive groups, and the network features what mathematicians call a heavy-tailed out-degree distribution.
Okay, let's translate that for us non-statisticians. Heavy-tailed out-degree distribution.
It basically means that while most genes regulate very few things, there are a rare few major hub regulators that control a disproportionately massive number of downstream genes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, this isn't an egalitarian system at all. It's a deep hierarchy. And this hierarchy leads to the fourth and perhaps most incredible finding, the ripple effect.
The ripple effect.
When a network utilizes these master hubs, it drastically shortens the communication paths across the entire genome.
Shortens the paths.
Yes.
So a genetic mutation doesn't have to travel through 50 middlemen to affect the whole system.
Right. In the networks that match human biology, regulators that are within just 2 hops of a target gene cumulatively explain 91.2% of its heritability.
Wait, really? Just 2 hops?
Just 2 hops. Because of the hubs, instead of a target gene having thousands of random upstream regulators diluting the signal over long distances, it typically has just a few tens of them operating through very short paths.
Okay, hold on. I need to challenge the evolutionary logic here for a second.
Sure, go for it.
If we have these massive master regulators, these hubs controlling hundreds of genes,
yeah,
doesn't that make the entire human organism incredibly fragile? I mean, wouldn't a single genetic mutation in a hub cause a catastrophic system failure? How is that an evolutionary advantage?
That is the classic vulnerability of what network theorists call scale-free networks.
Okay.
Think of the global airline network, right? If a small regional airport shuts down, the system is fine.
Yeah, nobody really notices.
But if a major hub like O'Hare or Heathrow shuts down, global travel is paralyzed.
It's chaos, yeah.
Our genome operates the exact same way. It is highly robust against random mutations in the periphery, which is where most genetic variation actually happens.
Okay, that makes sense.
But you are entirely correct. If a major regulatory hub is mutated, it often results in catastrophic developmental diseases or embryo lethality. However, the evolutionary advantage is that hubs act as massive shortcuts. They pull the distant trans effects much closer to the target genes.
Oh, I see. So the hubs act like massive biological funnels.
Yes.
They take all that sprawling, distant genetic variation and just focus it down into very short, concentrated paths, which prevents the genetic signal from being chopped up into 1,000 tiny, unmeasurable fractions.
Precisely. That concentrated architecture is the only way to maintain a biologically functional system while also producing the exact distribution of genetic variants we observe in real human data.
That is fascinating.
And this realization brings us to the major implication of this paper. This really represents a fundamental paradigm shift in how we view the genome-wide architecture of gene expression. It tells us that gene expression is actually less polygenic than we originally thought, but much more pleiotropic.
Okay, let's clarify those terms for everyone. Less polygenic meaning there are fewer total unique regulators for any given target gene than we assumed.
Yes, the sparsity we discussed earlier.
Right, and more pleiotropic, meaning a single master regulator gene has its hands in many different biological processes across the network.
Exactly. The same master regulators act on many different genes. Because these trans-EQTLs cluster at key master loci, the genetic variance isn't just randomly sprinkled across the 3 billion base pairs like dust.
It's highly structured around these hubs.
Highly structured.
So what does this paradigm shift actually mean for researchers who are in the lab today, you know, trying to find cures for complex human diseases?
Well, it completely changes their statistical approach. Because we now know the network is sparse, modular, and hub-driven, scientists can design new statistical aggregation tests that actively exploit this exact topology. Instead of looking for single, isolated genetic variants that slightly increase disease risk, they can hunt for specific disease gene programs, entire clusters of genes that are all responding to the same faulty master switch.
So instead of trying to silence a million random citizens shouting at once, the researchers now know they just need to figure out which executive's office to target to rewrite the instructions for the whole department.
That's a great way to put it.
That is a massive leap forward. But you know, as with all computational models, we do have to explore the boundaries of this map. What are the limitations of simulating human biology this way?
Right, and the research team is highly transparent about the assumptions built into their model. First, as we touched on earlier, the model assumes a linear flow of effects.
Yeah.
But in real molecular biology, protein interactions and binding kinetics can be highly nonlinear. Biology is full of sudden tipping points and threshold effects.
Biology is definitely more messy and analog than a clean mathematical multiplier.
It really is. Second, the model assumes a constant magnitude of regulation across the network, where every regulatory switch flips with roughly the same amount of force.
Which probably isn't the case in reality.
Unlikely to be the case, yeah. But the third, and perhaps most critical limitation, stems from the empirical data they match the simulations against.
The whole blood data.
Exactly. The human data comes from bulk tissue whole blood at a steady state.
Bulk tissue, meaning they took a blood sample that has T cells, B cells, platelets, red blood cells, and just blended it all together to measure the average gene expression across all those different cell types at once.
Yes. And because it is bulk tissue at a steady state, it cannot account for dynamic, time-varying developmental processes.
Right.
It doesn't capture how a specific cell network rewires itself when fighting off a virus in real time, or how these hub regulators shift as a person ages from childhood to adulthood.
There are profound single-cell nuances that this macroscopic model simply cannot resolve yet. If we go back to our city traffic analogy, it is like trying to understand how a single commuter drives to work during rush hour by only listening to the overall noise level of the entire city from a helicopter overhead.
That's spot on.
You can hear where the major highways and the big traffic jams are, but you completely miss the individual cars changing lanes or taking back roads.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. The helicopter view misses the microscopic maneuvers. But, I mean, we cannot let that detract from the sheer scale of what they have proven.
Definitely not.
Even with those macroscopic limitations, the structural constraints they have identified are incredibly powerful. They have mathematically proven that you cannot recreate the genetic data we actually see in humans without these specific architectural features.
Sparsity, positivity, modularity, and hubs.
Exactly.
Well, this has been such an illuminating deep dive. So to synthesize this journey for you listening, gene regulatory networks are not infinite, random hairballs of noise. They are highly structured, remarkably sparse, modular systems driven by incredibly influential hub regulators.
Right.
And this architecture concentrates genetic variants into fewer, highly pleiotropic master switches. And that understanding gives researchers a much clearer, much more navigable map for tracking down the elusive genetic variants that drive human biology and disease.
It fundamentally brings those distant, hidden trans effects out of the statistical shadows and reveals the actual logic of the genome circuitry.
Think back to that mysterious light switch in a completely different building. We used to think the wiring between our genes was impossible to trace because it was infinitely complex and totally unstructured.
Yeah.
But now we know the wires are actually bundled into massive, organized trunk lines. The biological network makes deep mathematical sense.
It obeys clear architectural rules, and knowing those rules is the first step to truly mastering them.
Which leaves us with a truly exciting frontier to ponder. What does this mean for how we might one day design targeted therapies that reprogram entire disease states from the top down, rather than just treating single genetic symptoms one by one?
It's an amazing prospect.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CCBY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Screens go. Shapes the weather, gives the chaos form. This stays constrained.